Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In 1944, Alice Cohn joined thousands of women who openly discussed the subject that most others only whispered about, their sex lives. The result of those private interviews was Alfred Kinsey's book, Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, published in 1953. Its explicit revelations shocked the world. Countries banned it, churches berated it, but it became a landmark book, and we mark the 50th anniversary of its publication on today's program. And after that, Alan Galley gives us some history of an aspect of American slavery few know much about, Native American slaves. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on September 26, 1775, Jonathan Chapman, better known as Johnny Appleseed, was born. He was born in Leominster, Maryland, but he earned his nickname from planting orchards all across the Midwest. He planted his earliest known orchard near Steubenville, Ohio, but in 1830 he acquired land in Fort Wayne, Indiana, where he planted an extensive nursery producing thousands of apple trees, which he sold and traded. Myth has it that Johnny Appleseed wandered the Midwest giving away apple seedlings and seeds, but in fact in 1806 he was charging 6 cents for a seedling. He did, however, travel hundreds of miles on foot, wearing clothing made from sacks, and according to one legend, with a cooking pot on his head for a hat. Chapman died from pneumonia at the age of 70 on March 18, 1845. His gravestone at the Johnny Appleseed Memorial Park, which is a few miles north of Fort Wayne, Indiana, is inscribed with the words, Johnny Appleseed, John Chapman. He lived for others.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a growing number of cities are considering measures that would require companies that require city contracts to search their corporate archives and disclose whether they ever profited from slavery. The cities have taken a cue from California. 2 years ago, the state began making insurance companies that do business there provide information about policies they or their predecessors issued to slaveholders, covering them for the damage or death of slaves. Last fall, Chicago passed a similar ordinance, and they're being considered in Detroit, Cleveland, and Los Angeles. None of the legislation calls for companies to pay reparations or specifies what would happen if companies found evidence of profits from slavery. But if they refuse to do the search, they won't be allowed to do business. And on a winter night in 1965, 3 weeks into a black voter registration drive in Selma, Alabama, an FBI tape recorder copied a speech by Martin Luther King Jr. in which he urged followers at the Selma church to keep their eyes on the prize, to pursue nonviolence, and to focus on the coming dawn of a new fulfillment. Until this year, the recording of the hour-long speech remained in the hands of an Alabama police informant. But the informant finally turned it in, and the text of the speech has now been made public in its entirety for the first time in the book Ripples of Hope, edited by Josh Gottheimer. This is Talking History.
When I was a little bitty boy, my grandmother bought me a cute little toy. Silver bells hanging on a string. She told me it was my ding-a-ling-a-ling-oh.
Ding-a-ling-a-ling-oh.
And then Mama took me to grammar school, but I stopped off in the vestibule. Every time that bell would ring, catch me playing with my ding-a-ling-a-ling-o. You know what I heard? I hear two girls over here singing in harmony. That's all right, honey. This is a free country. Live like you want to live, baby. Yeah. Ain't nobody gonna knock it, darling. Mm-mm. Yeah, freedom.
Alfred Kinsey and his book, Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, played a pivotal role in the study of human sexuality. This year is the 50th anniversary of the publication of that book, and to mark the event, Talking History's Jim Madison of Indiana University spoke with John Bancroft, director of the Kinsey Institute for Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction.
Sex has a history, and we're here to talk about it with Dr. John Bancroft, director of the Kinsey Institute for Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction, which is located on the campus of Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. John Bancroft himself is a distinguished authority on sexual behavior and the author of over 200 papers and one of the key texts in the field, Human Sexuality and Its Problems. We want to focus today on Dr. Bancroft's predecessor, the pioneer in the history of sex research, Alfred Kinsey, and particularly Kinsey's landmark study, Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, published 50 years ago in 1953. Welcome, John Bancroft.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with the founder of the Kinsey Institute. Who was this fellow, Alfred Kinsey?
Well, Kinsey was born in 1894 in New Jersey. He got his PhD in biology at Harvard in 1919 and came to Indiana University in 1920. And initially was a biologist committed to studying variability within species. And the species that he concentrated on was the gall wasp. And then about halfway through his career, in 1938, after getting involved in teaching a marriage course at the university here, he started his huge undertaking in researching human sexual behavior.
Is that a big jump, John, from studying gall wasps to sexual behavior? Is that...
It's difficult to think of a bigger jump, Jim.
Yes.
And he died in 1956 at the age of 62, fairly young.
All right, so he's teaching this course for students at Indiana University, and that connects then to this new research project on human sexuality, is that correct?
He, I think, was confronted by the paucity of evidence and information and knowledge about human sexuality. I'm sure he was intrigued by the subject before that, but this really motivated him to study it, and that's where he went for the rest of his life.
Right. So how did he study? How did he go about studying human sexual behavior?
Well, his principal method was to interview people, and he was exceptionally able at putting people at their ease, instilling confidence in them that he would treat their information sensitively and confidentially. And people found it extraordinarily easy to open up and talk to him about their sexual lives. He and his colleagues collected more than 14,000 of these interviews.
14,000 individual interviews.
Individual interviews. In fact, by the time the project finished, after Kinsey died, there were around 18,000 had been collected. That's a huge undertaking. And this led to his two landmark publications, the Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, which was published in 1948, and then the Sexual Behavior in the Human Female in 1953 that you've mentioned.
Yes, let's focus on that volume, the female volume, the 1953 volume, and that can help us understand his broader projects, I think, but specifically what he learned about human sexuality, what he reported in this 1953 publication.
It shocked the United States because it confronted everybody with the fact that women were more sexual than they were meant to be at that point in history. And, for example, he reported that 50% of women had had sex before they got married, 26% had had extramarital sex by the age of 40, 62% had masturbated. Basically, he was uncovering the fact that not only women were more sexual, but if you look at his data that he collected from different age groups, that women were becoming more sexual and more expressive of their sexuality as we went through the 20th century.
That is, younger women were more sexual than older
right.
women, his data suggests?
Right.
Yes.
So there were changes during the course of the century, which of course have continued since and in some respects have accelerated. There have been obviously... There were substantial changes in the role of women as a consequence of the Second World War, and these have continued in a major fashion in the second half of the 20th century with the role of women in the workplace, more women in higher education. In the 1960s, we had the introduction of the pill, which gave women more control over their reproductive lives. We've seen an increase in divorce rates, and patterns of relationships have changed. All of this has been part of the process of women getting more control over their own lives, and in the process getting more in touch with their own sexuality.
But you're suggesting that female sexuality was never static and fixed, that it was changing, and Kinsey sort of walks into a moving stream here. As he interviews women in the 1940s, early 50s, that he's interviewing women, and he's finding in his interviews changes at that point in history.
Yes. If you compare the women he interviewed who were born at the end of the 19th century with women who were born, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, you'll see quite substantial changes. Taking a longer historical perspective, the evidence would suggest that we see phases in human history when you have more substantial repression of women's sexuality than at other times. And I think, you know, the 19th century was probably one of the peak times of repression of female sexuality.
This is the notion of Victorian mores and such, right? What's the reaction then in America and even outside of America to this book published in 1953, Sexual Behavior in the Human Female?
Well, you had a part of the reaction was shock and disbelief that this was American women who were being talked about, and part of the reaction was relief that at last these things were being talked about, and of course people haven't stopped talking about them since, or writing about them. So there was a mixed reaction, but it reflected the fact that at that time there was a prevailing negative view of sexuality, which required women to be minimally sexual as necessary to conform with, you know, the requirements of being in a marital relationship and so on, whereas there's a lot more to sexuality than that.
Right. So Kinsey's findings of what people are actually doing is very different from what the mainstream of society is suggesting people ought to be doing. Is that a
exactly.
fair statement?
And that's
yes.
what caused all the stir.
What can you talk a little more about the stir, some examples of the way in which there was this negative reaction?
Oh, the book was condemned. Religious leaders were outraged by it. This was a denigration of American womanhood, and so on and so forth. Very much a sort of knee-jerk reaction from a society that just hadn't looked at women's sexuality in that way.
So was it even the point of talking about sex in the first place, or was it the actual findings that were a concern?
Both. I mean, I think it was striking. We've had so many people who are still alive today who were interviewed by Kinsey, who talked about what an extraordinary experience it was to be able to talk about this with another person, and how much they welcomed that.
And even women in marriages may
absolutely.
Not have been talking
yes,
about these
absolutely.
Issues. Yes.
Now, I think another important part of Kinsey's female volume, which incidentally was a lot better than the male volume in many respects, was that he focused considerably on the differences between men and women. This has received much less attention. But he obviously was concerned by the extent to which men and women didn't understand each other sexually and the negative consequences that might have in people's sexual relationships. So he spent a lot of time considering that. He exploded the myth of the vaginal orgasm, which was a sort of an important point in psychoanalytic views of women's sexuality, something which really he didn't get the credit for. Masters and Johnson got the credit for that subsequently. And he also got some things wrong. He came to the conclusion that sexuality of men was more psychologically determined and psychologically conditioned, whereas women's sexuality was more biologically conditioned. If you look at his own data, a better explanation is the other way around, actually. Women's sexuality has been controlled and shaped by social forces across the socioeconomic spectrum, showing the changes through history that we've already commented on. Men's sexuality did vary across socioeconomic groups at that time, and still does to some extent, but is never suppressed to the same extent as women's sexuality.
Why didn't he get more credit for these findings that you're talking about now?
Well, people were sort of fixated on the sort of raw facts of women's yes. sexuality rather than the more subtle interpretations. And rereading Kinsey's book, it's amazing how relevant it is today, the questions that, that he was raising, the questions that he couldn't answer at that time. And the last third of the female volume was given over to a very scholarly review of the literature on both men and women's sexuality, which I don't think has been surpassed in scholarship at any time before or since.
You made a comment earlier that you thought the female volume was better than the male volume. Is that because there's a comparative perspective in the female volume, or are there other strengths?
Yes, there are other strengths, too. I think he was a little less dogmatic and opinionated, much more referring to the literature than had been the case. He matured quite a bit as a sort of social scientist over those few years, and it reads a lot better. It has this excellent scholarly essay. He certainly was getting a better... Well, in some respects, he was getting confused about women's sexuality. He thought he knew about it at the time he wrote the male volume, but it was from a rather male perspective. And he realized it was more complex. And as I pointed out, he got some things wrong. But he was engaging with the issues. And I think one of the things that I often wonder about is if he'd lived a bit longer, how much further he would have got in really understanding this and explaining it.
Yes. He died how many years again after the 1953 volume?
3 years.
3 years later, yes. You, I sense, have a great respect for Alfred Kinsey as a scholar. Is that correct?
Do.
Can you just talk about that a little bit? What is the basis of that respect?
The field of sexual science has not been particularly rich in intellectual ability. It's not been the field that's attracted the superstars of the academic world. He stands head and shoulders above other researchers in the sexual field. He still does in terms of his scholarship and his ability. He was also incredibly committed. The enormity of his project, I think, makes us all pale into insignificance. And he had this sort of meticulousness and attention to detail, which is the making of a good scientist. He also had great integrity.
He worked very hard, I gather.
He worked very hard, yes. Too hard. That's why he died so young.
Yes. We should note that the female volume has been reprinted. Is that not correct?
That's
a few
correct.
Years ago, and you've written an introduction to it.
And it's been reprinted again just this year.
Yes.
Yes,
and
I wrote an introduction to the reprinting, which is my sort of assessment of Kinsey's work 50 years on.
Yes. Where would you place him in the history of the American women's movement or the worldwide women's movement? Is he a hero of that movement, in your opinion?
Well, he's had a mixed reception in the women's movement, and it varies, I think, it has varied over time. I think there are some feminist scholars who, first of all, recognize that the changes that he went through himself when he got to know and work with other women, people like Emily Mudd and Mary Calderon. And I think in many respects he has contributed to the women's movement, although in some respects some of his reactions and interpretations were somewhat anti-feminist.
And he is a man of the first half of the 20th
That's
century.
Right. That's right.
Yes, yes. I gather that the work of Alfred Kinsey continues, at least the work of understanding human sexual behavior continues at the Kinsey Institute today. Is that correct?
Yes. I think Kinsey would be quite happy with what we're doing at the moment. We're very much building on his work and focusing on individual differences and in a more theoretical way and a more experimental way than Kinsey did, but very much a continuation. And I think we're throwing light on the current debate about the nature and the important factors in women's sexuality.
What do you like best about this man, Alfred Kinsey?
What I like best about him, I think, was his compassion. Having read his correspondence, he was an incredible respondent to everybody that contacted him. That was a time when he had to use a typewriter. He was compassionate about people who were suffering. I like that about him.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with John Bancroft, the director of the Kinsey Institute for Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Once again, we've chosen a virtual site for our site of the week, a site where you can learn more about the legal history of the 20 most prominent court trials in American history, from the 17th to the 20th centuries. Here to tell you about the site is Kelly Schrum of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
Examine a Chicago Tribune cartoon at the time of the Scopes Monkey Trials, in which monkeys vote on whether or not they are related to humans. Or read H.L. Mencken's daily reports on the proceedings, along with trial transcripts, the Tennessee statute banning the teaching of evolution, and appellate court decisions on this remarkable trial. This exceptional legal history site includes 20 of the most prominent court trials in American history, including the 17th century Salem witchcraft trials, 18th century Boston Massacre trial, and 19th century Amistad-Dakota conflict, Johnson impeachment, and Susan B. Anthony trials. 20th century cases include Sacco and Vanzetti, Scottsboro trial, Rosenberg trial, Mississippi burning trial, Chicago 7 conspiracy, and the O.J. Simpson trial. Each trial offers historical background, biographies of key figures, and approximately 15 to 25 relevant primary documents, including transcripts of testimony, media coverage, depositions, and government documents. Most cases also contain images, links to related websites, and a bibliography of scholarly works. There are links to biographies of 5 trial heroes, including Clarence Darrow, as well as a constitutional conflict site that offers 29 topics for class discussion, such as gay rights, student searches, and the Electoral College debates. To locate famous trials, go to historymatters.gmu.edu, type famous trials into the keyword search.
And finally, we turn to the history of slavery, but of a particular kind of slavery in America about which most of us know very little, the enslavement of Native Americans. Alan Galley is professor of history at Western Washington University and the author of The Indian Slave Trade, The Rise of the English Empire in the American South, 1670 to 1717.
When Americans think of slavery and the international slave trade, they think of the tragic removal of Africans from their homes, transported through the deadly Middle Passage, the survivors sold to labor on plantations in Jamaica, Brazil, or Virginia. Less well known, largely hidden from view, was the capture and sale of tens of thousands of Native American slaves, who also spent their lives laboring for others in places distant from their homes. From Quebec to the Florida Keys, from the Carolinas west to New Mexico, both Amerindians and Europeans engaged in the enslavement of Native peoples. My own work focuses on the American South from 1670 to 1717, the peak years of the Indian slave trade in that region, when from 30 to 50,000 Amerindians were transported out of Charleston, South Carolina, which dwarfed the number of Africans imported in that same period. Virtually every group of Native peoples faced destruction from the trade, which engulfed the South in gruesome wars whose sole or main purpose was to capture humans. Huge areas became depopulated as the slave trade extended into every nook and cranny of the South. One could say it infected the region with a frenzy of slaving. From the capital earned, South Carolinians funded their plantations and purchased African slaves. It was as if one could create capital out of thin air. You simply had to capture human prey and march them to market. Indian slavery and the Indian slave trade can no longer be viewed as an historical aside or a footnote, for it was central to the lives of Southerners and in the development of the South. By the end of the second decade of the 18th century, the colony of Spanish Florida was nearly destroyed as the mission system was dismantled by Allied English and Native attacks, which extended all the way to the Florida Keys. French Louisiana tottered on the brink of destruction, as many of their Native allies in the Mississippi Valley were killed or enslaved. Numerous Native groups disappeared in the slaving wars, the free survivors forced to coalesce into new political entities like the Creek and Choctaw. A pan-Indian movement formed against South Carolina in the so-called Yamasee War of 1715, killing about 100 British traders and 400 Carolina settlers and nearly wiping out the colony. The enslavement of Indians in the South did not end, but the large-scale wars to obtain slaves ceased, in part because of the creation of confederacies powerful enough to resist enslavement. British planters turned to a plantation economy and African slavery as the basis of their society and wealth, giving birth to the Old South.
You've been listening to Alan Galley, the author of The Indian Slave Trade, The Rise of the English Empire in the American South, 1670 to 1717, published by Yale University Press, and that won the 2003 Bancroft Prize. And that wraps up another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments and suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. Our Site of the Week segment was produced by Amanda Schumann of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. To learn more about Talking History and the Organization of American Historians, visit our website at oah.org. To find out more about the Center for History and New Media, go to www.historymatters.gmu.edu. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
And I ride through the city at night. I see the stars come out of the sky. I see the bright and hollow sky. I see the city rip their sides. And everything was made for me tonight. I am a passenger. I ride under glass. Stars come out of the sky. I see the bright and hollow sky. I see the winding ocean dry. And everything was made for us tonight. Stars come out of the sky.